This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
On today's episode of The F Word, we'll be discussing skepticism in science. Our guest today, Amy Clausen, approached us a while ago to ask if we had examined the question of why the skeptical movement is so male-dominated, or looked specifically at women's relationship to science. In particular, a discussion about women's experiences at a recent skeptical conference in the U.S., discussed on the podcast The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, inspired Amy to bring this issue to our attention here at The F Word. Since this is one of the many topics that we have not yet addressed, we're excited to have Amy here with us in the studio this morning to get the discussion going. Of course, women's relationship to skepticism is a different question than women's relationship to science, though it seems likely that there's a fair bit of overlap. If there's a significant difference in how women and men approach science, it may go a long way towards explaining why women are underrepresented in a movement that places so much emphasis on science-based explanations. However, when we consider women's lack of participation in this movement, it's important not only to look at reasons attributable to women, like their attitudes towards science, but also at reasons attributable to the movement itself, like discrimination within the skeptical community. We're joined in the studio this morning by Amy Clausen, our guest today. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Amanda.
So the word skeptic is derived from a Greek word, meaning thoughtful, reflective, or inquiring. So to start off, I was wondering if you could explain a little bit about what skepticism is and what the modern skeptical movement is.
Sure. Skepticism and the skeptical movement can be, we can differentiate a little bit there. The skepticism, as I understand it, is a method. It's not a position or an ideology in itself. It is a method for investigating the evidence for claims before we accept them. So we're ideally skeptical people are critical of everything, and that means that we can ask for and evaluate evidence before accepting what we're being asked to accept. But it also means things like, there's a good quote by Carl Sagan, that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And that means that before we accept something that is beyond our experience and beyond anything that we thought possible, we're going to need evidence that is also equally impressive. The skeptical movement, I would say, in North America at least, there's a lot of organizations in North America that are promoting skepticism in various forms. And they talk about from the top down, I guess, as a kind of an umbrella organization that can help us start understanding where the other organizations fit in. The Center for Inquiry is a big advocacy organization, a science and science education organization. And it supports both the Council for Secular Humanism and the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, which has a good number of fellows that are researchers and science advocates and writers in their own rights. From most scientific disciplines, I would say, Richard Dawkins, Carl Sagan, Isaac Asimov, Bill Nye is a fellow. He's one of my personal science and skeptical heroes. And James Randi, who we'll talk about a little bit more in a minute. These fellows that are supported by the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry publish the Skeptical Inquirer, which I would say is kind of the main publication or the most widespread, well-researched, regular publication of the skeptical movement that produces articles that look kind of at all of the evidence for paranormal claims and the kind of pseudoscience items that are in the news or new research that's being done in areas that that kind of deserve a little bit more research. In general, I would say the skeptical movement is here to combat the uncritical acceptance of and support for paranormal claims. And in various organizations, depending on who's leading them and what their area of science is, what their personal area of expertise is, we'll see them looking at various kinds of claims with more criticality, whether that's in the medical field or in supernatural claims like ghosts and demons and religious claims, based on the scientist's own kind of area of research. That's where the critical direction will come from.
And in terms of the kind of organizations that are part of the movement, do most major cities have skeptical like groups that actually meet in person, or is it mostly in a kind of an online community? Or
I would say that I engage with this community entirely online. Mm-hmm. This is that partly because I'm accessing studies and blogs and research and podcasts that are produced and I can access through my mm-hmm. own computer. But there are skeptical meetup groups here in Vancouver. There are secular humanist meetup groups and other kinds of, you know, in real life meetup groups that branch off from various areas of skepticism, both here in Vancouver and in most major cities in Canada and the U.S., I have noticed. definitely an opportunity to engage in person if that's what people are looking for.
Mm-hmm.
I myself am happy to be, I don't know if I would call myself an armchair skeptic, but I don't feel the need to go out in to the bars to meet my fellow skeptics at this point.
So what was it that attracted you to this movement in the first place, and how did you get involved?
Well, I got involved from the comfort of my own computer. I started listening to some podcasts that were really entertaining, and it started out as kind of entertainment for me. I guess I have an inquisitive nature. I've always asked questions, and before I started listening to these podcasts, I did not identify as a skeptic. I didn't know that there was such a thing as a skeptical movement. I didn't know what that meant. And I started listening to some radio shows and podcasts that I really found interesting and challenging, and they led me to ask more questions, and I got involved in that way. What attracted me to it was the way that the skeptics that I was listening to were applying critical thinking to all kinds of interesting new avenues. And I have a background in logic. I did an undergraduate degree in philosophy, and I love argument. I love argument and debate, and I also love logic, and I love being able to take an argument and break it down to where we're making assumptions and where maybe those assumptions should be re-examined. And I'm also interested in finding, in my own arguments and in the arguments of others, finding where we have a logical fallacy, where we have just simply gone off the rails and our conclusion is no longer supported by our assumptions. And I think those tools of critical thinking are being used in the skeptical movement in a lot of interesting ways, from, as I mentioned, from medicine to other areas. And it really appealed to that sense of my inquisitive nature, and it appealed to me as a woman. Mm-hmm. In a way as well, because I realized pretty quickly how most of the research I was reading and most of the podcasts and blogs, the contributors are mostly men. And I'm not sure why that is, but I'm sure we'll talk about it.
So that kind of leads into the next question that I wanted to put out to you, and I don't know, Megan, if you have any comments on this either. Just why is it important for women in particular to be skeptical?
Shall I go ahead?
Yeah.
I can tell you why I think it's important for me to be skeptical. When I was 12 or 13, I did a series of media literacy workshops, and they absolutely transformed my feelings about things, and especially around media. And in media literacy, I found a real empowerment from being able to look at and understand, dissect, and kind of deconstruct images of women in the media. And that was a really kind of transformative for me, and gave me the tools of criticality when looking at images of women. And I think that as feminists, I think we can all agree that that's an empowering tool for us to have, to be able to look at images, not only of body images and the male gaze and other kinds of things that we talk about when we talk about perpetuating stereotypes through media imagery and stuff like that. Using our critical skills in that avenue, we have embraced those tools, and we are becoming a more well-developed, our criticism is becoming more well-developed in those areas. And I fear when I overhear conversations between women, and I certainly don't think this is exclusive to women in any way, but I fear that we're not using those same critical skills when we're applying to other issues. And I feel like media literacy is a really good place to start, and I think that scientific literacy is an area that we still have to look at. At not just as women, as humans.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really good point. It's definitely sort of become pretty popular to teach young women especially to be critical of images of themselves in the media or images of other women in the media, because it's so ubiquitous and we see it all over the place, and we are always having to contend with those kind of really narrow portrayals of women. And so to be critical of those things is sort of become a lot more common with the women's movement and some of the work that feminists have been doing in the last 30 years, especially with younger women. But I think that that's a really good point, that we do need to be applying that those same kinds of critical skills to all kinds of reports that we see in the media, and especially scientific reports as well. When I see the headlines in, say, newspapers or magazine articles about research studies that don't cite any sources, that don't give you any idea how this research was conducted, or, you know, whether the headline is even accurate, mm-hmm. you know, accurately reporting the findings of the study, and often it's not. I mean, the way that research is discussed in the media is frankly ridiculous, and most people have no tools to back check that kind of information, and will just kind of accept the little headline two bits of information and think that that's scientific.
I absolutely agree. I think the skeptical movement has been a watchdog in that sense, very critical of mainstream science reporting in the mainstream media. And there, a lot of science reporters are scientifically illiterate, and it's really, really damaging to have reporters and journalists who don't understand, as you just said, aren't going to understand or ask the right questions about the study and interpret those results and then make a responsible, you know, an accurate headline for those of us who are just going to flip through the newspaper and see a headline that is, you know, fear-mongering or that is shocking. I think we're preying on the scientifically illiterate reader in a way, and we are, in order to sell papers, obviously, I think the newspaper industry is trying to do all kinds of crazy things to make us keep reading their rags, but part of that is making headlines that are less and less accurate and more kind of shocking and really irresponsible. And that's why I think I turn to the skeptical community and all kinds of other sources for my science news. I would prefer to read science news from scientists, and hopefully those scientists and their community and their, you know, hopefully they have people who are also good writers and can help translate that research into language that I understand. I am not a scientist. It's important to me, though, that my news is coming from people who are conducting that research and who can speak to it.
Right. That's a good point as well. It does go kind of beyond popular reports of research into what's actually produced in the research. If we have the skills to actually evaluate the sources of scientific research and the products of that research, which most people don't unless they have a background in science. So, I mean, even if you are skeptical, it kind of requires that you do a lot of your own research and a lot of learning around methodology and statistics so that you can actually evaluate those studies, even if you get the sources from a popular media report, and then you go back and you look up the study, can you interpret that? Do you have any idea how to analyze whether or not those conclusions are valid, which a lot of people don't, and I think that that's probably a big problem.
Yeah, I certainly don't read in-depth studies and evaluate the data for myself in the ways that I would like to. If I had a more thorough science background, I think I would enjoy that. But I don't. And so what I instead have to do, and I think we all have to make these decisions for ourselves, is choose my source. And in my case, I'm looking for science news from credible sources where I'm seeing a certain amount of peer review. I'm seeing a certain amount of, like, that there's a journalistic standard that I can live with, and that I, you know, that I feel is responsible and balanced. I mean, the scientific community polices itself in a way that's what science is. It's a constantly taking somebody else's theory and refining it by doing more research and coming with new findings. And so when the scientific community is relatively in agreement with itself, and that, you know, in that certain journals have a good, you know, journalistic standard, and that the studies published therein are responsible and generally well reviewed by the, you know, those researchers' scientific peers. That's one thing, and getting your science news from Women's Day magazine is a totally different issue to me. Highly dangerous.
And we will come back to this idea of scientific authority later on in the hour. The question of why there's such a gender imbalance in the skeptic movement is currently being debated in skeptical circles, with the topic coming up on numerous popular blogs and podcasts in the skeptical community. Of course, we find some typical sexist explanations of this, things like women aren't given to critical thinking, they aren't objective or rational, and certainly they're not interested in science. Fortunately, some women who are involved in the movement have started speaking up about their experiences and pointing out that perhaps the reason women are so underrepresented has more to do with factors that are attributable to the skeptical community itself. Things like the aforementioned sexist comments and other ways that women are marginalized in the movement. For instance, there's been a lot of discussion recently around the treatment of women at this year's TAM7 conference, which is a big annual skeptical conference held in the United States, where women make up about 30% of the audience. According to contributors to a female skeptic blog, skeptchick.org, many female participants reported feeling invisible and ignored. There was only one female presenter in the whole conference, and some of the male speakers made overtly sexist remarks and jokes in their presentations. Additionally, a common theme was the assumption that the women in attendance at the conference were not skeptics, but they were only there because they had come with their boyfriends. So, Amy, I wanted to put the question out to you. Do you think that the skeptical movement is alienating to women in any way, or alternatively, I guess, why do you think that women might feel alienated by the skeptical movement? Do you have any insights into that?
I myself don't feel alienated by the skeptical movement, so I can't share the experiences at TAM. I was not in attendance at TAM. TAM is the amazing meeting, which is hosted by the amazing Randy, who's James Randy, the amazing Randy. He's kind of one of the grandfathers of the modern skeptical movement.
Skeptical guru.
Yeah, he's a guru, and he does this meeting, this kind of Las Vegas conference. And as you mentioned, there was a lot of feedback from that conference around how women felt. And I have a couple of insights. And of course, I wasn't there, so these are just kind of anecdotal. One, I, as a woman who self-identifies as a member of this movement but did not attend this conference, there could be many hundreds of thousands of us who are, you know, armchair skeptics or sitting at home interested in these debates and interested in these topics, but not about to travel to Las Vegas for a weekend with a bunch of geeks to talk about it. And to be frank, that's what this is. I mean, the skeptics are nerds, and I don't want to shy away from that at all. This is, you know, most of the skeptical blogs and podcasts that we see are serious in nature to some extent, but there's a lot of joking around, and a lot of those jokes revolve around things like Star Trek and computer programming. You know, I mean, that's a whole other conversation. Why is it mostly men who attend Star Trek conferences or who choose computer programming as their occupation? That could be a whole other issue here. But this is a nerdy movement, and as a woman, I'm not really interested in going and, you know, being a token attractive female in a room full of nerds. That's my choice there. But as far as the movement being alienating to women, I don't feel that way, and I think some of the comments that we're talking about here, some of these sexist and kind of semi-misogynistic comments that came out of these blog postings, I think, first of all, I think anybody who's commenting on a blog and is doing so in a kind of an anonymous way from home, all kinds of disgusting things come up in blog comments, and I certainly don't think that's exclusive to the skeptical movement. I think misogynists and racists and sexists and homophobes exist on every corner of the internet, and they're not going to shy away from provoking those kinds of discussions, and I don't necessarily think that's part of the movement. Although the movement is, at least in visible terms, at these conferences and at meetup groups, primarily Caucasian male movement. So there is that, and you know, we can't pretend that it's more diverse than that, from what I see.
On the podcast, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, where they were discussing this issue, they had a couple of women on to talk about their experiences there, and there are either one or two male hosts. There was at least three men on the podcast, and they all seemed quite open to listening to the women's experiences and didn't seem to have a really reactionary negative response, which was pretty refreshing to hear. But just in some of the limited research that I've done on this in the last couple of weeks, a couple of things did kind of stand out to me. And one thing that we were talking about the other day was something about, I can't remember what forum it was, but they have a douchebag award that they give out to someone who they think is, you know, not skeptical enough or is promoting something that they don't particularly agree with. And that in itself is quite sexist. You were saying that Jenny McCarthy, because she believes that a vaccine caused autism in her child, has now been awarded this douchebag award. And I mean, I just don't really see how calling Jenny McCarthy a douchebag is contributing to any kind of collection of knowledge. And it's certainly not something that would curry favor with most women. Even if the claims that she's making are not accurate or are not based in science, I still don't think that most women would react favorably to that sort of name-calling to a woman who's, you know, concerned about what's happened to her child and raising questions about that. A few other things that kind of stand out to me about the ideology of skepticism is that it really seems to start from a point of disbelief, from this position that any claim is sort of false until proven with science. And I don't know if that's a fundamental gender difference, but it seems that it might have something to do with it. I don't know that a lot of women would start from that as an initial position, that they won't accept anything until they have evidence. It seems like something that might be a little bit alienating, that really oppositional attitude. And also in a lot of these forums, the orientation doesn't seem to be towards discussion or debate. You don't see a whole lot of, at least again in the kind of limited research that I did, I didn't see a whole lot of conflicting views. I saw really concerted efforts towards directly attacking and dismantling views that don't happen to be popular or that aren't favored by people who call themselves skeptics. I don't know if you have a comment on that or not, but
if you guys don't mind if I jump in.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I think that hi. There's something to be said about this idea that if something can't be proved by science or the scientific method or rationality, that it's less valid.
Mm.
And this is an idea that's gendered, and I think that's because, not because women are less rational or because women are less interested in science, but historically and culturally, science has been a male domain. And that means that women's knowledge, whatever that means, non-scientific knowledge has been discredited. And science has been gendered as something that is masculine, whereas emotion or feeling or, you know,
any kind of personal experience, really.
Exactly. So, yeah. Something like your gut feeling or your feelings about something. Perhaps you don't trust something and you don't have scientific reasoning behind that, or there is no necessarily rational reason, that becomes something that's female and therefore invalid. So I think that partly this means that women might be intimidated by the scientific community or by the medical community, for example, because they don't have this kind of language. Perhaps historically they haven't had access to the same kind of education. They didn't have access to the same kind of education 100 years ago. You know, we're made to believe that we have to trust these experts. We have to trust these people who have scientific knowledge, who have scientific language, who are more trustworthy, whose opinions are more valid than our opinions because they have this scientific knowledge and scientific value, which means that women often, or minorities often, are excluded from that conversation.
Mm-hmm. I think that, yeah, that's one of the big things that came up for me too. I mean, this sort of refusal to accept individual experience, personal experience, as any kind of evidence that's even sufficient for a provisional acceptance of something, even in the absence of a systematic scientific inquiry into a subject. There's a lot of things that haven't been systematically examined by science, and insisting on some kind of external standard of, you know, objective validation often is equated with disrespect and complete dismissal of women's experiences. And Megan, as you brought up, especially in terms of women's interactions with the medical system or authority, they often give women a distinct sense that their knowledge of their own bodies, it doesn't matter. It's not relevant.
I just want to jump in. Megan, you mentioned in the same sentence, women's knowledge, and I'm doing air quotes with my fingers for those who are listening at home, women's knowledge with non-scientific knowledge. And where I just want to point out that the idea that scientific knowledge is men's knowledge and that women have some other kind of knowledge, whether it's experiential or traditional or feeling-based, emotional, whatever those, whatever our, you know, female knowledge base is, I think that's extremely dangerous. And I think it's extremely tragic to count ourselves out of the scientific process and to count ourselves as women to reject science or to reject the scientific enterprise, although it has been misguided. Obviously, women have been excluded from it, and therefore the basis of scientific knowledge has been generated by men. We are still using that knowledge every day and contributing to that knowledge, and I think I feel very strongly that where women's knowledge becomes conflated with superstition, that's where I think we run into really big dangers, is when we reject the scientific enterprise, and that is, you know, hypothesis and analysis and theory and all of the kind of parts of the scientific method and of critical inquiry that make that knowledge. When the alternative to that is to superstition or paranormal claims that are not being investigated with a kind of same kind of critical thinking cap on, when we allow it into our conversation and don't hold it up to those methods and don't hold it to the light of scientific inquiry, I think we're really doing ourselves a disservice.
What I'm saying is not necessarily that men have an innately different kind of way of thinking or knowing than women do. I don't think that it's ever productive or healthy to start talking in dualisms or binaries, like as in women are this way, men are this way. But I think that what's been pegged as being, I don't even want to call it women's knowledge either, mm-hmm. but it's this culture versus nature idea, this emotion versus rational. It's that scientific knowledge has been gendered as male, whereas other kinds of knowledge have been labeled as female. And because of that, other kinds of knowledge have become less valid. And because science and because the medical community have been co-opted by men and therefore become a male kind of knowledge, it becomes more valid. And we talked a little bit earlier, and I think this is an important example, about women who were having issues with their breast implants. And companies that make breast implants are mostly run by men. And studies are done to say that these breast implants are safe and not problematic, and that they don't cause cancer, and that they're not going to leak into your body, and they're not going to cause damage. And yet all of these women are coming forward and saying, I know there's something wrong. I know there's something wrong with my implants. I know that my health is being impacted by this. I can feel it. I don't have any means to test myself in any kind of scientific way. I don't have a scientific study to back me up, but I have leukemia or I have chronic fatigue. And they're being shut down because these companies or these scientists are doing studies that say, nope, these implants are safe, you're nuts. And that's been happening for decades or centuries, where women are being called crazy because they feel something or they know something, and or they have some kind of knowledge about their own bodies, and they're not being trusted because they're not doctors.
Well, yeah, this idea that there is some kind of fundamental conflict between an individual's personal experience of what's happening and an aggregate statistic that talks about, or that gives us some knowledge of a population, or gives us a knowledge of a general trend. And that's, I think, where we often see that kind of a conflict. And we think, well, someone who's using their own individual personal experience to come to a conclusion, well, that's suspect because it's only one person. But here I have this study where I have an aggregate statistic and it shows that, you know, 95% of people, blah, blah, blah. There's still that those nuances that are lost. And the idea that somehow that personal experience and moving from that towards something that could be a scientific subject of study or that could direct scientific inquiry, I mean, that's inductive reasoning, and that is used in science. So there isn't, I don't think that there is a fundamental contradiction there, but when you see sexism coming in and power and authority interacting with those things, and you do see those types of moving from my experience to something that could be generalized being sort of looked at as being feminine and not the right way of doing science. So I think at this point we have not covered even half of the things that we wanted to cover. So Amy, you're going to have to come back and join us on the F Word again.
I look forward to it.
So we've been talking about women in science and women's relationship to skepticism. And we've covered a couple of topics, but we haven't covered them all. So I think we're probably going to have to reopen this topic again in the future. Amy, was there anything that you wanted to say just in closing?
Yeah, sure. I had a closing quote here, which addresses some of the issues that have come up today. It's from Carl Sagan, who's one of the kind of great-grandfathers of our skeptical movement. He's talking about the Center for Skeptical Inquiry here, and I'm going to edit a little bit, but he says, "Have I ever heard a skeptic wax superior and contemptuous? Certainly. I've even heard, to my retrospective dismay, that unpleasant tone in my own voice. There are human imperfections on both sides of this issue. Even when it's applied sensitively, scientific skepticism may come across as arrogant, dogmatic, heartless, and dismissive of the feelings and the deeply held beliefs of others. It is imperfect, but it serves, here he's talking about the Center for Skeptical Inquiry, serves an important social function as a well-known organization to which media can apply when they wish to see the other side of the story, especially when some amazing claim of pseudoscience is judged newsworthy. We represent a counterbalance to the pseudoscience gullibility that seems second nature to so much of the media." Carl Sagan.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us today, Amy.
My pleasure. I look forward to coming back. Thanks.
Great. And so now over to Megan for a little current events piece or current events rant. I'm not sure which one it is. We'll see.
It's fairly ranty. Male violence in sports have been interconnected both on and off the field for decades. Hockey fights are not just common, but encouraged and expected. Dozens of professional male athletes have been charged with assault, rape, and physical abuse, and we hardly blink an eye. It seems to be considered as part and parcel in sports, unless, of course, the athlete in question is a woman. This past month, you may have seen a video of University of New Mexico soccer player Elizabeth Lambert circulating online. It's received quite a heated response. Extreme reactions have ranged from death threats to come-ons. One website actually ran a poll asking, "Do violent women turn you on?" in relation to this incident. And you could either vote, "Not at all. Women are crazy enough without the threat of an eye gouge." Or, "Absolutely, I like my ladies passionate." It's extremely condescending and offensive. Bloggers and articles discussing Lambert's attractiveness, calling the incident a sexy catfight, and generally linking sex and violence popped up all over, exposing the way in which we continue to have dualistic views on acceptable female behavior. Lambert's actions, granted, were aggressive, violent, unsportsmanlike, air quotes, but the shock and outrage with which they were met prompted even Lambert herself to make the statement, "I definitely feel because I am female, it did bring about a lot more attention than if a male were to do it." Never mind that when men fight in sports, we are never shocked. We continue to view male aggression as natural and, let's be honest, uncontrollable, what with all their testosterone. On Monday, Gian Gomeshi discussed the incident and the response on cue with sports commentator Bruce Daubigan, who seemed to think that women playing sports is super cute, condescendingly commenting that seeing females playing tough and pulling each other's hair, i.e. in contact sports, is a novelty. He then goes on to criticize Lambert for playing the woman card. That's right, the woman card. Claiming that we are now, and this next phrase actually makes me want to yank him down to the ground by his ponytail, post-gender. And therefore, no one buys that old, and I quote, "It's only because I'm a woman, so I'm being looked at excuse anymore." That some men seem to have viewed this with titillation or as sexy catfighting is just typical of a media that loves to diminish women and force them into sexy porn scenarios regardless of what they are doing. The fact of the matter is that not only would male athletes not receive these kinds of comments in response to a punch in the back, but we would not even be talking about it. We are talking about it because Lambert is a woman and because male aggression and violence in sports is viewed as appropriate and expected, whereas female aggression is not. I think it's fair to stop pretending that gender is a non-issue when we read the headline, "Elizabeth Lambert Video, Attractive, Aggressive, Suspended Victim," or "The Elizabeth Lambert Incident, Too Tough for a Girl." And when we criticize her for playing the gender card, guess what? It's not a card, and we play it because it keeps coming up in the deck.